Well, good day to you. It's Joel with The King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
You're listening to Where We Are, a weekend conversation on faith, politics, family, and culture, hosted by me, Michael Ware, and my wife, Melissa. We bring our wide-ranging experiences in politics, ministry, and nonprofit life to bear as we discuss the issues of the day. On this week's episode, we'll be talking about love. Love in philanthropy, love in politics and civic life. This is Where We Are. This is Where We Are. We are the Wheres. I'm Michael.
I'm Melissa.
Melissa, we had Easter break, and now we're back. Good to be with you.
Nice.
We're talking
to
about
you.
We're talking about love this episode.
We are.
Not our love, though that is always the background of this podcast, but love as the will to good.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll dig into that a bit more. Before we do, just want to let folks know I'm going to be in Gainesville.
Florida.
Gainesville, Florida. Yeah.
Because there is Virginia.
In Virginia. Okay.
Because remember, we lived around there.
You are correct. That is a true thing. Gainesville, Florida, April 7th and 8th. I'll be preaching both services at First Presbyterian of Gainesville on Sunday morning. I'll be doing an education session in between. So, you know, if you go to the first service, you could save for the educations. If you go to the second service, you could attend the education service before service. And I'm really looking forward to that. And then the next day, I'll be giving a lecture primarily for pastors and ministry leaders that I'm really excited about, hosted by our friend, Michael Sakasis, at the Christian Study Center down there in Gainesville. If that's not enough to lure you out for folks in Florida, in the Gainesville area, I will have a special guest with me, the one and only Saoirse James Ware. This is our first... We've done... like personal trips before, but this is the first time I've taken her solo on a work trip, and she's been counting down the days. She is so excited.
She's been adorable about it. She's very excited to be in Florida because she associates Florida with beaches.
Yes.
So there you go.
So I'll be taking her to the beach. We're going to drive the like hour and a half to get to the beach, and so we're excited about that. I am hoping that she is content to sit while I am giving my talk and doesn't recognize that as an opportunity to do whatever she wants, which it really
is. Slash be a showboat.
Which it really is. And so, you know, we'll see how this goes. But would love to see you out at First Pres this weekend. Two more things, Melissa. One, I had a piece run at Mere Orthodoxy this week on political therapeutic deism and Christian nationalism, and appreciate Mere Orthodoxy for running that piece. It's generated some good discussion. Would encourage folks to check that out. And if you haven't picked up the spirit of our politics yet, would encourage you to do so. Now is a great time to pick up that book.
Now, you also wrote another article this week, and that's what we wanted to discuss. And that's why we're talking about Louvre.
Yes, Louvre.
So glad you went with that.
Yeah.
So you wrote for the Chronicle of Philanthropy because they just launched, with you and a few other folks, something called the Commons, which is funded by a few philanthropies for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. So you're joined by, like, the president of the Ford Foundation, Darren Walker. You're joined by Rachel Pritzker. You're joined by Danielle Allen.
Governor Spencer Cox. We love him.
We've talked about him quite a few times on this podcast. And, yeah, you and I have been talking for a good while now, especially because you've launched a nonprofit. And one of the reasons why you were asked to write for the Chronicle is that you are a nonprofit voice amongst, you know, these many voices. Some people are coming from the actual philanthropic background. Some people are, you know, in the nonprofit space, like you, advocacy. Some are skeptics. And especially since you've launched a nonprofit, and this deals with the whole of our politics as well in our public life and sort of discourse narratives, for some trends that we're seeing. And in the piece, you talk about specifically towards nonprofits or philanthropies who are funding nonprofits, who want to be funding civic work, politics work, you know, work that affects our public life. You say that you can't actually serve people that you do not love. And, you know, in the piece...
And that trying to do so is a recipe for spurring the same kind of distrust, division that at least ostensibly so many of these efforts are supposed to mitigate. Yeah.
Yeah. And because you and I have noticed a trend that part of what gets clicks, part of what gets you money, part of what gets you notoriety is there's a lot of, like, bashing of different groups, especially if you've once been a part of that group or you've, you know, you're, like, serving that group. It's really it's been an interesting thing to see, and something that we've noticed is that, you know, you can't actually do good work, do deep work, do work that changes minds or changes beliefs or changes behaviors if you secretly actually just don't like the people that you're trying to serve, that you actually, when you get down to it, don't really wish them well, don't want to will them to good, which, you know, is a, you know, as you say in the piece, Aquinas's definition of love.
Yeah.
What, I mean, take us into the conversation that, you know, that you and I have sort of behind the scenes on this kind of thing.
Yeah, so to zoom maybe a bit out from philanthropy, I think what the piece is trying to address is that particularly in a polarized environment, that invites and facilitates civic actors, whether they're philanthropy, politicians, advocacy groups, etc., that often explicitly and definitely implicitly suggest that their activity, what they're aiming for, is meant to harm some stakeholder.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, even when this is only implicit, or to take the argument even further, even when it goes unsaid that you are willing the good, that breeds distrust.
Mm-hmm.
It breeds fear and embattlement. Now, in the case of philanthropy, in some ways, it's important in a different way, in that philanthropy, there's no democratic accountability there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't even say, though I don't recommend saying this, well, you know, you lost. You know, mm-hmm. like you lost in a political contest, and this is sort of the democratic will, and decisions have to be made, and, you know, your side, your interests lost the election, and so, you know, there's no obligation to will the good. Now, again, I, like, deeply contest that. But philanthropy can just act. It has resources. It can act in pursuit of its mission, its goals, and often does so with sort of grand vision casting for what they hope to accomplish within a sector, a community. And often what comes across is the kind of change they seek to impose on that community. So it's not we're doing this with the community. It's how sometimes it can be heard is we have the resources and we're pushing an agenda. And so the piece, which again, the Commons is just this wonderful new initiative from the Chronicle of Philanthropy about bridging divides, role of philanthropy in healing division, and bringing diverse people together. The piece really argues against a view that expressing clearly a will to good for those who are impacted by your philanthropy, and again, I think you could zoom out and this refers to our civic life more broadly, is somehow weak or sentimental or, you know, flowery rhetoric, but really what matters is the data and the hard numbers. No, the motivation matters. How you communicate your intent, and obviously what your actual intent is, matters a great deal. And so that's the piece.
Yeah, I mean, can you extrapolate this out further for folks? Because plenty of our listeners are not working philanthropy or, you know, that's just not what you're thinking about. Thinking more about, like, sitting at a dinner table and disagreeing with someone or, you know, in the daily work that they do with their vocation and how they're thinking about their role in politics. Because, I mean, the spirit of our politics really gets down to towards the end of the book of, like, your own role and how you can change your own disciplines and things like that.
Yeah, so I think one of the concepts from the spirit of our politics that applies here is this concept of bearing one another's burdens.
Mm-hmm.
That's from Galatians 6. I've in the book, I apply it to our political life. And it's this idea, again, not just of this the absence of a will to harm,
mm-hmm,
and indifference, but this call to will the good, to bear burdens of others that may not even necessarily be your own burdens. And so this applies to philanthropy. This applies in our politics. How do you participate in politics? Are you just going to our politics to secure your self-interest narrowly construed? Or is your politics motivated by love, by a will to good for your neighbors? That makes a big difference. It's also, you can even take like civic engagement, like engagement in political institutions out of it. And it's when you're in political conversation, when you're in political disagreement, what is your spirit in that conversation? What are you trying to get out of it? What are you trying to do to those that you're talking with? And I mean, this is a great sort of point to reference on our Substack this week at wherewear.substack.com. We interviewed our good friend John Anazu about his book, Learning to Disagree. And I think that book, along with David Brooks's new book, that like these are books about in what can so often be a transactional sort of culture of suspicion, actually, how can we enter into conversations, be in the public square, be engaging in political discussion in a way that respects the dignity of those that we disagree with, who may oppose us? And this is vital. I mean, one other thing I'd add here is, I referenced this op-ed that ran in the Chronicle maybe 2-3 years ago by Suzette Brooks Masters, Suzette Brooks Masters. She's a longtime leader in philanthropy, and she wrote this essay reflecting on her time doing philanthropic work on immigration issues. And she wrote this essay, the title of it is Philanthropy Needs to Own Up to its Role in Fueling Polarization. And in this, I thought, pretty courageous and vulnerable op-ed, she reflects on how she allowed her conviction in the rightness of her cause to essentially ignore and not properly respect those who disagreed with her. And what I liked about the essay is that it wasn't just, like, it would be enough to say, like, that was wrong, like, I shouldn't have done that. But she also advances this case that it harmed her own efforts, like, that she was less successful. And I think that's so counterintuitive, though it shouldn't be. But we have a politics right now that says that how you succeed is to focus relentlessly on your own interests and scrape and claw and do whatever you need to do to advance your own argument, to not give any quarter to the other side, etc. Like, there's a moral argument against that. There's, like, a pluralistic argument against that. I also think often, very often, in the short term, and especially in the medium and long term, you're harming yourself. You're harming your own cause. You're harming the very people that you're claiming to serve. And so this op-ed, which is for the Chronicle of Philanthropy, is focused on speaking to the philanthropic sector, I think has broad implications for our civic life and really just our own personal life. What are we doing when we're in conversations with those that we disagree with, or when we're in community with those that we disagree with? What is our posture towards them?
Yeah, I asked the question because I felt like what you're talking about, specifically down to the most individual level, like the familial level, the sort of community level, and where we feel like we hear from listeners all the time, readers of the Substack, when you go and speak, you have people emailing you, the programs you own with CCPL, you hear from people all the time about some of the toughest things that they're going through right now with our political discourse and how divisive everything is, and, you know, the political sectarianism, the hyperpolarization, all that, the whole thing, is that when you go home to the Thanksgiving table, it is rough. And, you know, people can easily name, like, 3 to 4 people in their life where they can barely have a conversation with them because they disagree so much on what is felt as fundamental issues, identity issues, like all kinds of stuff. And a lot of the time, one of the sort of insights, I guess, not an answer, I mean, it could be an answer, that you have for people who ask you these questions of how do you navigate this and how do you do it, is you often come back to them with Dallas Willard's concept of joyful confidence, of the fact that, you know, our politics is not separate from everything else, that Jesus is walking with us, that he understands everything that's going on, and therefore, when you're putting on the things of Christ, you can walk through all these tough conversations, these tough situations with joyful confidence. And I know that if you've ever felt like, you know, does our politics feel, you were always asking, does our politics feel like there's a pervasive sense of joyful confidence, well-being, and most people are like, no, definitely not. That it feels so lofty sometimes, but actually when you pair that with this idea around, again, one of the most simple concepts that we have as Christians, because God is love, like it's one of the most, you know, sort of fundamental things about our being, about our lives, about the kingdom of God, is that when you actually approach these really, when you are about to go home to Thanksgiving or whatever holiday you're about to go home to, and you're going to be sitting at a table with a relative or whomever it is, somebody who was you once considered a close friend, but you or their ideas about the world have changed. When you enter into these conversations, trying to seek that joyful confidence, this posture of taking your own self-interest and actually going after these conversations with the idea that you're trying to knit yourselves together and that you're doing that because of love, I think actually makes the joyful confidence part a little bit more possible,
yeah,
a little bit more feasible, a little bit more practical, and not something that is lofty or idealistic or something that, you know, other people are able to do, but I'm not able to do. I don't have the skills. Actually, you do have the skills, especially if you're somebody who walks with Christ, you do have the skills. If you approach it in that way, that the joyful confidence might actually be easier in these conversations if you are approaching it in an other-centered way, even if that person themselves might not actually be giving you that courtesy back, but seeing it modeled might actually help them as well.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think that's right, Melissa. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts about this episode, the article. Again, it's at the Chronicle of Philanthropy, part of its new initiative, The Commons, and the title of my essay is Care More for People Than Ideology. The subhead is Philanthropy Often Seeks to Influence People We Do Not Love. That is dangerous. And so would encourage you to check that out. Again, you could also check out my article this week from Mere Orthodoxy on political therapeutic deism and Christian nationalism. Melissa, just one other thing I wanted to mention on the pod today, which is the Center for Christianity and Public Life, as we've mentioned on the show before, is running a high school program. A high school program that will begin this summer. It's a 5-day civic experience for Christian high school students, rising juniors, rising seniors, and graduating seniors. And the application deadline has been extended to April 15th. That will be the final deadline. We have a wonderful, lovely group of students that have applied. Part of the application is sending in a 2-minute video where the students share about their interests in civic life and their Christian faith. And I can't wait for this program. And if there's a high school student in your life, if you are a high school student, we'd love to have you apply to be a part of this program. And you could read more about the program and apply at ccpubliclife.org.
I think you'll really love it. I've seen the design of the program. It looks like it's going to be so much fun those 5 days. You also told me about these videos that they've sent in, and I just kind of want to just squeeze them.
Yes.
They all just seem just very, I just remember being that age and getting into politics, and yes, I think a program working with teens is just such a great idea and so much fun. And when we talk about future generations, like that is the age. That is the age where a lot of people start getting their interest in civic life, yeah, and then potentially choose some kind of career in it and things like that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's all we have for this episode of Where We Are. Thank you for listening. We'll be back, of course, this week with The Morning Five. Until then.
Oh, bye.
It's the end of the weekend, but I still wanna turn up. Yeah, I still wanna turn up. All I want is to go again, but you ain't picking.